This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program which we call the Big Picture, in which we attempt to examine all of the dots and make sense out of them. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. It is hard to believe. I'm still wondering where it went myself. The first half of the year is over, but so far, things seem to be looking good. I mean, the GDP is picking up. Unemployment is at record lows. Inflation is moderate. Stock market is in positive territory, but not by too much, I should point out there. Corporate earnings up double digits. And of course, the classic question you always ask at this stage of the game, what could possibly go wrong? Well, there's trade wars and rising oil prices. So the thing you're probably wondering is, what does the second half of this year look like? Will it be pretty much the same as the first half of the year, or better, or maybe a gradual worsening? And whenever we try to answer those questions, we look at the leading economic indicators, the LEIs, and see what they're telling us about the second half of the year.
You know, there's a saying about the business cycle, they never die of natural causes, they're killed by the Fed. And as we have mentioned here numerous times on the program, 11 out of the last 12 recessions were preceded by Fed rate hikes. So here we are again, right in the middle of a Fed cycle. And if you take a look at the futures market right now, they're pricing in about an 85% probability the Fed will raise interest rates in September. And right now, it's about another 53% probability for December. So two more rate hikes. So by the end of the year, we could see the Fed funds rate at 2.5%. And also a harbinger of maybe what may lie in the future, the spread between the 2-year and the 10-year has fallen to roughly around 34 basis points as the yield curve flattens, a possible sign of future problems. But right now, for the moment, and probably the rest of the year, the LEIs are pointing to future economic growth, no recession in sight, and if we look globally, the U.S. has the best-looking house in our global neighborhood.
All right, well, if that's what the LEIs are predicting, are we going to just sit back, or should we actually be vigilant about possible trouble spots?
Well, John, you know, things are looking very strong, at least for the U.S., but we're starting to see plenty of signs of a global slowdown, especially in Europe and Asia and South America. So as I mentioned, the U.S. right now is the best looking house in a global neighborhood. If there is trouble brewing, it's likely to occur in the emerging markets, as we've talked about, problems in Turkey, problems in Argentina, and even possible problems coming ahead from Mexico and Chile. So looking at the U.S., it's looking pretty good right now. If there's problems, once again, they're probably going to occur overseas.
So having said that, let's do a survey of the United States in more detail. Why, if things are looking so good, Jim, have the markets been in such, reluctance? Is that a good way to put it?
You know, we've been going back and forth, unless you're in technology. And as Gary Dorsch and I were talking in the first hour, six stocks, the FANG stocks and Microsoft, were essentially accounting for over 100% of the gains in the S&P 500. So we've gone back and forth between positive and negative. Overall, we're still positive for the year. What I want to do is let's get into the weeds here. This time I want to break the LEIs into four categories to kind of give you a glimpse of what it looks like underneath the hood. We're going to look at four areas. One is GDP and the main LEIs. Second is what I call hard economic data. That's everything from durable good orders, factory orders. The third is the regional Fed surveys. And fourth is what we call soft data. Those are kind of like consumer confidence levels, small business confidence levels, real estate confidence levels. These are what we call soft data, what people are thinking, which sometimes precedes what they're actually doing or may want to do. But I want to begin with GDP because that's the big number that we all focus on. And if you look at the main LEIs, GDP for the last couple quarters has been growing at 3% or above. Now, it slowed down in the first quarter, something that we've seen repeatedly throughout this almost 10-year economic recovery. They softened in the first quarter, but if you take a look at what the LEIs are saying right now, we should get a 3% or better, maybe even as high as 4%. For the second quarter, it's looking like a 3% print for the third quarter as well. So if you look at both the Conference Board and the ECRI index, they've softened somewhat, but both indexes indicate stronger GDP growth ahead. And that's why, John, when you see all the political things that are going on, whether it's geopolitical turbulence or just plain political discord here in the U.S., the market seems to shrug it off. And maybe it's down for a week, down for a couple days, but then it bounces back. And one of the reasons is the economy is on a very strong footing, which acts as a shock absorber when you have all these kind of outside events. And the other thing I might want to point out is the recession index, which started to go up in the first quarter as the economy weakened. It's been rising and it got as high as 16. Well, as of May, it's starting to fall again as all the indicators are indicating this economy is firing on all cylinders right now. The weakest areas of the country right now are probably the east, south, central area. But overall, the trend for the U.S. economy is looking to get better and back above 3% economic growth, which is good economic news, especially for corporate earnings on the top line as well, because there was fears that mainly a lot of this increase that we've seen in corporate earnings, a lot of that is attributed to the tax cuts. But what about the real economy? As the economy picks up, what does that translate into? Higher top-line revenue growth for companies, which is always good news for profits.
What about supporting data? I mean, housing, autos, things that are directly influenced by rising interest rates.
Well, you know, housing, despite all of that, is still looking strong despite a rise in mortgage rates. On this Friday, we've got 30-year mortgage rates above 4.6%. We've got the 15-year mortgage rate at 4 3/8 and 7-1 adjustable rate mortgages, meaning that they're fixed for about 7 years. It's roughly at 4 1/8. But here's something that we're starting to see in this economic cycle that we haven't seen as much in past economic cycles. It's a new phenomenon in housing, which is Wall Street is raising money in funds to purchase not apartments, but to purchase single family homes. Single family homes have become far more attractive to investors than apartments where you have a nationwide glut, which has driven down rental yields. One firm just raised over $1 billion to add to their existing portfolio of over 26,000 homes. So now we have a new factor in the housing market, which is institutional investors, and that's helping to shrink inventories. It's driving up prices, and with low inventories, it means there's less homes available for sale. So we're seeing residential real estate morph into another investment class with the entrance of sovereign wealth funds, insurance companies, hedge funds, pension funds, and asset managers. And these are the big guys with deep pockets. And, you know, it was interesting. I even saw an ad in an institutional magazine for a bank that was willing to lend individual investors up to $10 million for residential real estate. So if we look at the real estate market, their indicators, it still looks strong, but there is some signs it's starting to weaken. And part of that is there's a lack of available housing inventory, so we're certainly not in a bubble. Homes are difficult for individuals to find suitable homes in areas they want to live. And we do have rising mortgage rates. As the Fed continues to raise rates, we should see mortgage rates continue to climb. Many are predicting that we could be at 5% or more. And if we look at some of the more recent indicators we've seen in housing, pending home sales have been falling steadily since January. New home sales, probably not as tight as existing market, but the big trend that we're seeing with builders now is for lower priced houses. That seems to be the strongest area in the market. The weakest end of the market is up on the upper side or the upper end. Another trend that probably will weigh on the housing market in the months ahead is mortgage applications are trending down. They're down about 27% year over year. So if mortgage applications are down, that kind of coincides with what you're seeing with pending home sales dropping. The one bit of good news, however, is mortgage delinquency rates are down, falling about roughly 54 basis points. Roughly right now, the delinquency rate is down to about 4.6%. So unlike the last downturn, John, where real estate was the epicenter of the bubble, we're seeing no signs of that in real estate right now. With the exception, maybe if you want to go around the San Francisco Bay Area and a few other areas that have gotten overcrowded and expensive.
The big one, however, in our economy would seem to be the consumer, which normally rotates around retail sales and, of course, car sales.
You know, look at the other hard data. We find similar data in terms of what we see as an improving economy. Let's begin with some of the big ones. The ISM Manufacturing Index is at a near record level. New orders are strong. One thing that we're keeping an eye on is rising prices. The prices paid component is up about 12 points since November. So that's pointing to some pipeline inflation rising ahead. We're also seeing an increase in supplier deliveries, which could signal up ahead a little slowdown. The ISM non-manufacturing index also close to record high. New orders are up. And at least here on the service level, prices paid has been drifting lower. Other hard data, things like industrial orders, durable good orders are positive. One area that remains positive is the consumer. I mean, retail sales have posted 3 months of positive gains. I don't know what it's like, John, where you live. Been going to the store over the last couple months, to the malls, as we've had out-of-town guests from out of the country. They always love to go to American shopping centers. And my goodness, the parking lots were crowded. I call it my parking lot indicator. And also, some of these recent gains that we've seen in retailing have been broad-based. Miscellaneous retail sales, building supplies.
Yeah, and what's supporting all that, Jim?
You know, John, for the first time in many years, we're seeing rising wages, tax cuts that went into effect beginning in February, a strong job market. Also, we're starting to see a rise in consumer credit. And a lot of that is supporting retail sales is this consumer credit. Headline credit is picking up again. It jumped nearly $25 billion in the month of May. It's expanding along with the general economy. And I think that's reflected in what we're seeing in consumer confidence, which remains high. And you can see credit could be supportive to additional consumer spending as we head into the final quarters of the year. So not only are retail sales rising, but oil sales have also picked up recently. We're tracking at an annual rate of roughly about $17.5 million. And you're seeing the results of this spending being reflected. If you look in the stock market, the strength of the consumer discretionary stocks this year has remained one of the top performing sectors.
So overall, if we look at what you're saying here, as I'm understanding it, the U.S. economy is showing really numerous signs of improving out there, which I would think is going to bode well for the economy in the second half of this year.
Well, there are a few storm fronts, as we talked about at the beginning, on the horizon, which we'll get into at the end of this segment. But right now, John, everything is looking good for Q3 and Q4. And surprisingly, we could have a very strong finish to the end of the year.
Now, we have the regional Fed surveys, which track economic activity. Are they supporting the same things we're discussing here? Are they making pretty much the same observations?
You know, there are a number of Fed surveys that are slowing, and they're sort of a mixed picture when you look at the regional Fed surveys. For example, the Chicago Fed Index is showing economic growth decelerated in the month of May, and that's the first negative print that we've seen since January. The Kansas Fed survey showed just the opposite, with very strong manufacturing activity in the region. Other surveys, such as New York and the Empire Survey, are showing continued strength in manufacturing, which is a good sign, and that lines up with the ISM report. And a couple of these are at near record levels. So the one Fed survey that showed additional weakness is the Philly Fed survey, which is an important one because it remains in positive territory, but is one to keep an eye on because it covers a lot more activity in the 50 states. But overall, the Fed surveys remain in positive territory with some signs of weakness, but it's too early to tell, and 1 month's weakness does not represent a trend.
Anything else that you would say is relevant to what we're talking about?
The final category is the soft data, which are consumers' business confidence, which measures how people are thinking. If you take a look at recent surveys from the Consumer Confidence Index to housing and small business, all are exhibiting a bit of weakness in falling in the month of June. You wonder sometimes a lot of that can be attributed to things in the news or the market. You know, the market falls down for a couple of weeks, you'll usually see the Consumer Confidence Index weaken. But faltering business and income expectations were the main reason that the surveys fell in June. Also, inflation expectations are remaining pretty high. And that's an interesting one to watch. As I mentioned, in a lot of the regional Fed surveys and the ISM, both manufacturing and service, we've seen the prices paid component begin to rise. So rising interest rates, rising gasoline and energy prices, in my own opinion, are behind much of these declines that we've seen recently.
So then your extensive collection, as I would call it, of LEIs is pointing us to a pretty strong uptrend for the U.S. economy and probably no signs of recession for the rest of this year anyway.
You know, John, the only risk that we have right now is the markets are expecting two more Fed rate hikes. But at least right now, the economy remains pretty strong. And that was pretty much the message I got with an interview I did with Ed Yardini this week, who believes that, you know, a lot of this stuff that we're hearing about the trade wars is just simply background noise, and he expects a better economy and better markets for the remainder of the year.
I think this will become increasingly background noise. The stock market's starting to come around to that view that, you know, let them shout at each other, and eventually they'll sort it out. Meanwhile, let's focus on whether the fundamentals are being affected, and right now there's not much evidence that that is in fact the case.
In that interview, he also talked about his boom-bust indicator, which takes a look at raw commodity prices. He doesn't like the futures market with speculators in it, and he uses that with comparison with unemployment trends, and he said it's almost at a record level. So at least, John, right now, things are looking pretty good, and if there's any kind of storm fronts, they're more likely to come overseas.
This is something, by the way, we've covered too, Jim, in previous shows. If there is a crisis of this time around, most likely it's going to originate from one of two ponds, either from Asia or coming across that pond, so to speak, the Pacific Ocean, or from Europe rather than in the United States.
Yeah, and this is something, as you mentioned, John, we've covered in past shows, and as Gary and I were talking about it in the first hour, almost two-thirds of the overseas markets are down by 10% or more. And the problem is, as the Fed continues to raise interest rates and shrink liquidity, the problems in the emerging markets are only going to get worse. You're already seeing this in Asian markets. You've got currency problems in Turkey and Argentina. And at the same time, you also have the second largest economy in the world, China, is slowing down. So things in Europe aren't much better either, with the biggest export engine in Europe, Germany's economy, weakening with export sales shrinking. So once again, the U.S. still remains the driving force behind the world's economic growth because of our size of our economy and incredible amount of imports. I mean, our trade deficits are over $600 billion a year, which is one of the reasons why you're seeing President Trump be so adamant about some of the trade agreements that exist between us and our trading partners. But, you know, we do carry large trade deficits. However, some of those trade deficits are necessary because U.S. dollars fund world trade. And if you don't have dollars, in which most transactions take place, that makes it difficult. And it's one of the reasons why the dollar has been so strong, is it's not only interest rate differentials here in the U.S., but it's also the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet. In fact, in the fourth quarter of this year, they'll be shrinking it by $50 billion a year. That's $600 billion a year. That's almost equivalent to raising interest rates 2 percentage points. So sooner or later, this is going to have a toll. So just as we've been discussing strong LAIs here in the U.S., global LAIs have peaked and will only get worse as the Fed continues with these rate hikes and quantitative tightening. So once again, if you're looking at a place to put your money, the best place remains in the U.S. However, how long this will continue, John, I have some doubts in terms of 2019. If the Fed continues to raise rates and shrink its balance sheet, pulling $600 billion out of the markets over a year, that's a lot of money. So what we're seeing right now, at least, strong U.S. market, global economic momentum has peaked, it's rolling over, and sooner or later, it'll be slowing here. And what we're seeing is that turbulence overseas, John, it's only a matter of time before it reaches the U.S. shores. It's kind of like the analogy I use. You know, you're sitting on the beach in Florida, everything looks sunny today, but 1,000 miles offshore, there's a tropical depression that's forming, and that's emerging markets and overseas. Sooner or later, it eventually arrives on land. And we don't know when that's going to be. It could be the end of the fourth quarter. It could be sometime in the first half of the year. But sooner or later, it reaches here.
But it does seem that if we look at the Fed, they seem oblivious to the effect that they're having, especially its policies on overseas markets and economies. And one wonders how long it is before they're going to wake up. But right now, the U.S. is the main cylinder of global economic growth. And so we bring it down, as we always do here on the show, to the question, what does that mean for investors?
Well, as Gary Dorsch and I were talking in the first hour, you've got about six companies in the S&P 500 that have accounted for almost 100% of all the gains. And as I pointed out here, you know, we're safely invested in a good portion in short-term sovereign debt, areas that we begin to like, and one thing that you always see towards the end of a business cycle, and we're starting to see that now, is the emergence of energy and consumer staples start to lead as you approach the end of a business cycle. Now, energy has been a strong element since the beginning of the year, and what we've seen here over the last 3 weeks is the breakout of consumer staples. So as you start to see these things, once more, it's sort of confirming, John, that we're towards the end of this business cycle. And as Gary talked about, if this market continues for another month in positive territory, it will be the longest running market cycle in history. If the economy carries on into next year, it'll be the longest running business recovery in history. So we're getting late now, whether it's the eighth or ninth inning. Quite honestly, I don't know. At least with the indicators right now, probably says we're probably between the seventh and eighth. But I would expect all of this trade rhetoric will eventually dissipate. It'll be background noise, as Dr. Ed Yardini and I discussed this week. And as we get closer to elections, look for that to go away. And that could produce a strong catalyst for a year-end rally when combined with stock buybacks. And you usually see the strongest period of buybacks take place at the end of the year. So there could be a couple strong catalysts to give us a strong finish.
And so overall advice then to investors?
I would say be selective, keep some powder dry, and hedge your portfolio as things are only going to get more volatile.
And coming up next, we're going to talk about oil, oil spikes, and oil storms as the Big Picture and the Financial Sense News Hour continue at financialsense.com.
Since January, the markets have become more volatile. Uncertainty has returned once again to the financial markets as the Fed continues to raise interest rates, and market liquidity has become an issue. We know eventually the Fed rate hikes could lead to another recession and bear market, which would put your portfolio at risk. Do you have an exit plan or a plan to protect your principal during the next market downturn? Well, many of you don't, and that is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. Give us a call and let us help you develop a strategy that helps you navigate both bull and bear markets and give you the peace of mind that you are prepared for any market outcome.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
This week we spoke with Ed Yardeni at Yardeni Research. It was a very interesting conversation that we had, and the title of that was Trade War is Background Noise as U.S. Economy Plows Ahead. And Jim, I want to ask you about some of the different comments that he brought up. A lot of interesting insights from Ed Yardeni, and actually I didn't know about his background, but it's pretty interesting. He worked at the U.S. Treasury for a time. He was even at the Federal Reserve in Washington. He was chief investment strategist at Deutsche Bank. I did not know just how extensive his background is. And I know that he's a very well-noted strategist. You had him on, I think it was about a month or two ago, to talk about his book, Predicting the Markets. That was also a really interesting interview as well. But let's talk about some of the things that he mentioned. What was the backdrop of the conversation itself?
A number of things that we talked about, Chris. Let's talk about what's been in the headlines all week, which is all this back and forth on the U.S. escalating tariffs against China. And he brought to the attention of our listeners is that this occurred under Reagan. There were similar events that took place then, and eventually they got resolved. And as Ed Yardeni said, a lot of this right now is going to be background noise, because he said there's a lot more positive things that are going on in the economy. And Chris, I want you to play that clip where he talked about the economy at full employment, the best of both worlds, because he said he really, when you take a look at the economy, when it is strong and it's growing, it is really a better shock absorber when you have a lot of political things going on, whether it's geopolitical tensions or it's trade tensions as we're seeing now.
The economy is at full employment. We've got 6 million people unemployed, and we've got 6 million jobs that haven't been filled. So we're basically at a level of unemployment that's often called frictional. It's a skills mismatch, or it's a geographical mismatch. So we've got sort of the best of all worlds right now.
Now, Jim, the big thing that you guys touched upon in this interview was trade tariffs, of course, the trade war. He referred to it as a trade skirmish. He didn't think that we were yet at a trade war. But one of the comparisons he said is, if you're looking for a historical comparison, look at what happened in the 80s during Reagan.
If you're looking for a historical analogy, you can go back to the mid-80s with Ronald Reagan. As much as people recall that Ronald Reagan believed in free open markets, he actually imposed some pretty restrictive tariffs on Japanese semiconductors, 100% actually. And he also imposed quote-unquote voluntary import restrictions on the Japanese. And guess what? It worked. The Japanese brought a lot of their production to the United States. So Reagan, like Trump, is, I think they're both free traders, but they're also fair traders. They don't like to see America being taken advantage of with unfair trade practices. It's not pretty to watch. And the market every now and then does have a little sinking spell as these things go on. But I think increasingly the market will view it as background noise that will eventually be sorted out in a way that's favorable for the United States.
So, you know, once again, his reference that a lot of what we're seeing going on, and we've seen this with this president, Chris, where he'll go all out either in an attack mode or go for, you know, I want this, 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 I want 10 things, and then he settles for 5. It's kind of like a negotiating tactic. And so what he was basically saying there, look, this is a lot of noise right now that the markets are concerned about. But at the end of the day, it's not going to escalate or become anything like what we saw with Smoot-Hawley in the 30s. Another thing that I also thought he brought up, which I think was very prescient, and that is how different this market is and what has been driving it. And one of the things that we talked about in hour one with Gary Dorsch is that how big the corporate buybacks and the M&A activity have been over this last decade. A lot of stocks, Chris, have been retired, and a lot of this money that's coming back from overseas because it's taxed at a lower rate, a lot of that is going back into stock buybacks and dividends, which Yardeni says is a good and healthy thing for the market.
Yeah, I know that that's something that you have brought up on the show in the past, is that in many cases, you actually want to be looking at those companies that are engaged in buybacks and dividends. Sometimes these are referred to as shareholder-friendly companies. And if you just look at the past, gosh, 6 months, year, multiple years, we have seen a pretty large outperformance by a number of those companies in particular that you highlighted that are part of that shareholder-friendly group. And so he was basically, from listening to interviews, interview, he's pushing back on perhaps the bearish argument, saying that this is just a bad thing. And so he was giving more of a positive view on this. And again, he notes that he tends to take a more optimistic outlook. But he's been a pretty, I would say, timely strategist. I mean, he's made a number of really good remarks on the economy over the years. He has been very accurate. So definitely, if you follow him, you'll know that his research is very widely respected in the industry. So a lot of great insights. This was definitely more of a bullish look on the economy and the market. You know, it wasn't all roses, though. There were some things that he said that he was concerned about. He talked about inflation, that's definitely on his radar. He's been in more of the disinflation camp for a long time. But as he noted, there's a number of indicators that he's watching on the inflationary side, just in case that's going to rattle the market. So very interesting interview. And I do want to encourage all of you who haven't listened to it to do so. You can go to FS Insider and access it there on our website. For any of our subscribers, it's right there for you to access. Just log in. For those that aren't subscribers and would like to, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button, and you can sign up for a month or a year, whatever you prefer. But in addition to Edyard Denny, we have a number of really good guest experts on every week, so you can definitely access that on financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Welcome back to the Big Picture on the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Popolava, John Lefter here with you. I'm sure if you follow the program, you know we've done a number of shows on the rising prices of oil after much admiration for the dramatic plunge that the prices took recently. And of course, now they're rising back up. We've been talking about the fact that they are rising and now indicators that they're probably going to rise even more. And I've been driving between Idaho and Colorado this last week, Jim, and I'm checking prices and they are indeed up everywhere.
Just a curiosity, John, what kind of prices are you seeing? Because here in California, we're already over $4.
Yeah, we're about all the way between Idaho and Colorado. They've been around $350, $360. That's for premium, by the way. $350, $360.
Oh, okay. Because nationally, I think we're just slightly below $3 if you're looking at regular, but you know, premium is over $3. We're $4.30, $4.40, $4.50, depending on where you're buying gas in California. I recently had friends coming over from Arizona. They said they had to fill their tanks up in Yuma because as soon as you cross over the California border, the price of gas jumps by almost a dollar.
Right. Well, you've got to do something to keep Jerry Brown in Sacramento. So, but in seriousness, you think we could be heading for an oil spike. What do you think is driving that?
You know, John, if you take a look at what we were talking about between 2014 and 2016, we were talking about an oil glut. Well, guess what? That oil glut is gone, and now we're talking about shrinking inventories. So as we've discussed numerous times on the show, there's one element that you have with oil that's very important, and that's geopolitical element. And if you take a look at, for example, events recently, OPEC's decision, for example, to cut back on production by 1.8 million barrels a day, that's a political element. Number two, take a look at what's driving prices now, economic sanctions against Iran. Number three, political disruptions like Venezuela, Nigeria, or Libya. So the real question right now that oil markets are dealing with is deciphering what is spare capacity. Nobody worried about that when they were storing it on tankers and we were afloat and awash with oil. But, you know, the real question now, is there enough to overcome the political disruptions that we're seeing coming from not only Venezuela, but also Iran? So from where we see things, the oil markets are looking very bullish based on a number of factors. Number one, increased oil OPEC supply barely covered Venezuela's production losses. A couple of weeks ago, you saw a drop in oil when it was mentioned that Saudi Arabia and Russia might start increasing. Well, they're going to increase production between 500 and 600,000 barrels. We'll tell you why we don't think it's going to be much more than that. John, that was barely enough to cover what has been lost in a drop in Venezuelan production. They're saying right now we could be down to 1 million barrels a day coming out of Venezuela. This was a country that was producing 2.5 million barrels or exporting 2.5 million barrels a couple of years ago. And as we take a look at it, there was a big drawdown in inventories. And if you look at inventories, a more important thing to look at is the number of days consumed those inventories will last. Right now, we're below 30. So on paper, OPEC is raising production by 5 to 600,000 barrels, but Venezuelan production is falling faster than expected as the country's grave turmoil and the risk of the government falling are completely collapsing. So eventually, you're going to see oil prices spike, just as we've seen over the last couple months here. The production cuts could come off the table eventually. But John, there's a real big question because the Trump administration is going for total sanctions, which would remove 2 million barrels if everybody complied of Iranian oil production. That's a lot of oil to take off the market at the time. OPEC has cut back its own production by 1.8 million barrels.
So if we descramble what that means for people, I'm trying to understand it.
Well, you know, higher oil prices will weaken demand and increase U.S. shale. But, you know, the one thing as we take a look at, it gets down to this. Inventories are shrinking. Demand has increased. Supply has been cut back. And even if we look at possible increases that could come in possibly, let's say, from Saudi Arabia or Russia, or possibly even come in from U.S. shale, U.S. shale production, it's going to be sometime by the end of the second quarter, maybe third quarter of next year, before shale production can increase significantly, because we're running into bottlenecks. They don't have the pipelines to get this to the refiners and to the ports. And so a lot of this leaves an open question. And John, I've seen all kinds of estimates that go all over the map. Quite frankly, I don't think anybody really can pinpoint it indefinitely. But what we do know is inventories are shrinking, demand is increasing, and that does not bode well, especially with inventories down to about 28 days of supply right now. So any kind of geopolitical shocks coming from Venezuela, Nigeria, Libya, or Iran can only add and create the price spikes that we've seen and possibly could be seeing more of as we head forward.
Okay, let's put the stoplight over on trade sanctions against Iran. Now, these are supposed to go into effect in November. They probably won't hit the market per se right until the end of the year. How does that play?
You know, this is probably the $64 million question, and that is how big is spare capacity? Because as you mentioned, Iran is the third largest oil producer within OPEC after Saudi Arabia and Iraq, with daily production of roughly about 4 million barrels a day. They export 2.1 million barrels. So right now, the U.S. is pursuing the elimination of all of Iranian exports of oil. That is one big number, but we really don't have a handle on what the spare capacity within OPEC is. Now, Saudi Arabia, and some are claiming, can produce up to 12.5 million barrels, but the most they've ever produced, John, is about 10.8 million barrels. So the question is, hey, you say you can do it, but we've never seen you do it before. In ramping up by your production by 20%, you know, that's something a lot of people are calling into question.
But you know, when you say this, invariably somebody is going to mention U.S. shale production and the ability to offset that. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, U.S. shale production is probably going to be hitting close to 11 million barrels a day. Next year, they're saying it could be 11.5 to 11.8. The problem, John, is they can't get the stuff to the market. And they're working on pipelines so they can get the pipelines to the refineries and to the ports and load them onto ship. But those pipelines aren't going to come into play until the end of the second quarter of next year at the earliest, more likely the third quarter of next year. So what good is it if you can produce another million barrels, but you don't have the capacity to get those million barrels to the market? So, and it doesn't look like OPEC will get that aggressive with production increases because they're very much aware of what's going on in the U.S. with shale production. So the last thing they want to do is really ramp up production, number one, if they could. And there's only a couple countries that could do it, mainly talking about Russia and basically Saudi Arabia. There's a few minor players like Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, that could probably add to production. But, you know, what happens if Libya goes off online, which it does so frequently with political turmoil, Nigeria, the same thing. And also as Venezuelan oil production drops, I mean, right now, Bethesda is being run by a general who has no experience in the oil business. So it's not going to be until maybe late next year, maybe in the third quarter, that you can really count on U.S. shale production to come to the rescue. But right now, the only available spare capacity, really, of any magnitude is really Saudi Arabia and Russia. The three main players in the oil market today is Russia number one, the U.S. number two, and Saudi Arabia number three. And by next year, the U.S. could be number one, which is one reason that gives us a lot of clout in the oil markets, because we've already surpassed Saudi Arabia. We could soon surpass Russia as well. Russia's producing roughly about 11.2 million barrels. Possibly they could add about another 125,000 barrels. Saudi Arabia's at 10.8. So if you're really looking at who the big swing producer could be in the next 12 months, it really is the U.S. There's just too many questions on whether Saudi Arabia can go from 10.8 to 12.5 million barrels and do that quickly.
Well, if we assume then, Jim, from what you've said, that spare capacity isn't there, is there anything that could offset another oil spike?
I mean, you know, sometimes when things spike like that, you could see, you know, obviously the U.S. could release oil from the Strategic Petroleum Oil Reserves. But, you know, that's only a short-term measure. And you could see it, however, if gasoline prices really begin to spike at the pump, especially around election time. But right now, at least to the end of the year and the first half of next year, things look pretty bullish for oil and energy stocks, which have become one of the market's leaders.
I want to go back to the previous segment here on the program, because when you were talking about rising interest rates, what really pinged off in my head was rising oil prices and how these things will interact in slowing down the economy. And we have to tie that almost to what you were talking about, the Fed. The Fed is raising rates when all these other things are going on as well.
Well, the one characteristic about recessions, John, if we look at it since World War II, there's two characteristics that precede them. One is rising interest rates with the Fed rate raising cycle, and the other one is rising oil prices, especially after the 1970s. Now, if we take a look at what the Fed is doing, as we talked about in BP1, it's really pursuing a very aggressive monetary policy through not only raising interest rates, but also withdrawing liquidity through the market through its quantitative tightening program. And this, however, the good news, as we talked about in the last segment, it's being offset by massive fiscal stimulus and dollars flowing back into the U.S., which is capping U.S. interest rates. So fund flows and fiscal stimulus has dampened the impact of these Fed rate hikes. You know, we're looking at 30-year treasuries below 3%. 10-year treasuries have come back down. A lot of that is capital inflows coming into the United States, money repatriated by U.S. corporations with trillions of dollars overseas, and a lot of money coming over here as a safe haven in turbulence, as we're seeing in Europe and emerging markets. But trouble in emerging markets and their economies and oil spikes could change the economic scenario dramatically over the next two quarters. Unlike rate hikes, however, there is nothing, and I mean nothing, the Fed can do when it comes to a rise in oil prices other than kill the economy, which historically is what they always do.
So right now, Jim, you think things are looking up, and it seems like politicians are having summits lately. So why don't you sum it up for us?
Okay. I mean, right now we expect oil prices to remain firm, if not higher, and possibility of spikes, especially if we don't resolve this issue with Iranian oil by November, because that's when sanctions go into full effect. And if the Trump administration is talking about removing 2 million barrels of their exports off the market, John, that is an awful lot of oil, and I just don't think you can replace it. And I don't think any president nor his party would want to go into a presidential election with rising and spiking oil prices and rising inflation. So that's not a good thing. But right now, we expect the energy sector to remain bullish and energy stocks to remain a leader in the markets.
And you know, Jim, I'm thinking about this from a political standpoint, because as you pointed out about presidents who were elected at the end of business cycles and in rising rates, they rarely get elected to a second term. And it seems to be almost a race right now between all of these factors, the rising interest, the 2018, but really more so the 2020 elections, and the rising prices of oil, all of which could have a negative effect on the economy. Everybody seems, well, not everybody's happy. There's a lot of political infighting going. We know that. But from a economy standpoint, everybody seems to think it's puttering right along. So it's going to be interesting to watch and see what the timing of all of this is and see how it ultimately plays out. Obviously, Financial Sense is going to be here to do that. So what do you see in the weeks to come?
What are we looking at? We should get our first look at first print of GDP for the second quarter. It's expected that'll be over 3%. Some say as high as 4. So we're watching those LAIs. But John, we're full steam into corporate earnings for the second quarter. So everybody's going to watch earnings, looking for a pickup or a slowdown, especially top line numbers as the economy improves. So we're heading full steam into corporate earnings season. And of course, next month coming up in August is the Jackson Hole Conclave, where the Fed officials get together. So everybody's going to be looking at the little nuances, what was said, how tough is the Fed going to be? Are they going to remain on track for two more rate hikes or more? Those are the things coming up for the end of the summer. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.